Good morning and welcome to Neocony View. I'm Peter Newman, and our guest this morning is the Fire Chief of Nehalem Bay Fire and Rescue District, Perry Sherbaugh. Good to be with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
One thing we should tell our listeners, one thing we are not going to talk about over the next half hour, we're going to stay away from the politics and the election of a few months ago. The vote was in. We're moving on from that. We're going to talk about summer. We're going to talk about the consolidation of the fire district and new building coming up, public safety both for the summer and, of course, I guess preparing for the big one. Boy, you have a lot on your plate at any given moment, I'm guessing.
Right now we do, yes.
Yeah, so let's start with the building. That there's this consolidation taking place, and what is happening?
Okay, well, currently we're still working out of all of our operations are occurring out of the Nehalem station. Our administrative offices are at the Manzanita station. Our water rescue operations are out of the Manzanita station. And then we have a couple trucks stored in Wheeler. So the goal by getting a new station up is getting us centrally located in one place to conduct operations. And we're hoping that that will be finished in mid-October and move in end of October, first of November.
Was there much of a the whole that's physical consolidation? But we
yes.
also had the consolidation of various departments.
Well, you know, actually, it was only the consolidation of Nehalem and Manzanita were the only functioning fire departments.
Mm-hmm.
All the other entities contracted with one or the other, and we had already been conducting drills together for a couple years now with Nehalem, Manzanita, and Nehalem, and so it was a pretty easy transition for the fire department personnel to merge together. We had a good working relationship. We were able to merge the associations, the Volunteer Firefighters Association, with relatively little trouble. And so, you know, a lot of districts have issues when it comes to merging different departments, and people have different ways of doing things, but we virtually had the same policies and had been working so closely that it was very little growing pains in that direction.
So what is the total staffing of the whole operation?
Right now we have... I'm paid as the fire chief. We have a paid division training chief, a part-time administrative assistant, and right now we have about 26 volunteers on the department.
Now, you know, you think about a volunteer, which is a pretty big job volunteering for that, but I think a lot of people don't realize the kind of training that a volunteer gets is it's you got to learn everything you got to learn.
Correct. They don't realize that being a volunteer firefighter is no different than being a Portland paid firefighter. They have to learn the same material. You know, their standards put out by the National Fire Protection Agency, OSHA, has adopted those standards, which in essence means you'll do it. And then, of course, we have Department of Public Safety standards and training that have their standards. And so our guys are required to go through the same training that any other firefighter in the state would go through before they can enter a burning building. And we do train to the Firefighter 2 level, which is the highest NFPA level for firefighting, as well as we have pumper operators, we have drivers, we have hazmat awareness and operations. And so there is a ton of training that these folks go through. And that is firefighting. Then you get into your technical rescue, rope rescue. That's a whole separate training program.
Who does that? Who trains the
We have volunteers. Steve Van Dyke is our trainer for the rope rescue program. And again, that's a whole separate training program in and of itself that takes place. Then on top of that, we have the water rescue program, surf rescue. And that's a whole other program that they have to get trained in. And these drills all take place on separate nights besides just the fire draining night. So these folks go through a lot of training. The average firefighter in a year puts in over 100 hours of training.
And I imagine it's not a static thing because, for example, sadly, if there's an accident, a firefighter or a rescue person is injured, there are investigations. People learn from it.
Correct.
I imagine that learning gets passed on in the subsequent training.
It's always progressing. The training, I'll use motor vehicle crashes for an example. You know, 5, 10, 15 years ago, we didn't have hybrid cars. So you go to extricate a person out of a car today and it's a hybrid car, you could be electrocuted if you're cutting in the wrong place. So you're constantly updating the techniques used in rescues, during firefighting. You know, things are learned. Wind-driven fires, for example, we've learned that on a used to be you just, you know, fight fire this way and this way only, but now we're learning through, unfortunately, firefighters' deaths in the country that firefighters are being killed because of wind-driven fires and structures the heat, kind of a blowtorch effect, coming down the hallway and cooking them, you know. So you have to look, you know, what's the wind doing outside? And so it's a constant changing environment that we're always trying to stay up with the latest cutting-edge technology on dealing with these situations.
Well, we are going to get around to talking about preparations, as they say, for the big one. But I guess the thing that's happening right now is we're coming up on summer, 4th of July, which has got to be, you know, on a regular calendar. Is that headache day?
That is a headache day.
It may not be the headache day. But
besides the festivities, you know, the parades and all that, we tend to have more calls that day than other given days. Obviously, we have fireworks. So within the week leading up to and after 4th of July, sometimes we're dealing with brush fires and things like grass fires on the beach because folks are careless with fireworks, or beach fires, more of them. And so, yes, that's going to be a busy day for us.
Now, are you in any kind of an enforcement responsibility? So if people have illegal fireworks, are you on the lookout?
No, the Manzanita Police Department takes care of the enforcement of the fireworks, state parks and the Manzanita Police Department.
You just see the results.
Yeah, yeah. we've had one grass fire already this month, beginning of June. We have had a couple pretty significant fires in the past from fireworks, carelessness with fireworks. One grass fire led to a structure fire. We were able to contain very quickly because we were already fighting a grass fire. But so, you know, we just ask that people, you know, when they're shooting off their fireworks, they stay with their kids while they're doing it and just think about it. Don't be shooting them off in the directions of trees or, you know, the brush. They need to be out in a clearing area.
Our guest this morning on the Econi View is Perry Sherbaugh, who is the fire chief of Nehalem Bay Fire and Rescue. And as you probably have gathered by listening to the sounds in the background, we're recording this at the station, which I think sounds kind of cool. You're probably used to all these sounds, but we might hear a radio go off or some alarm of some sort. It's just part of the sound this morning. Well, we also have water out there, rivers, the ocean, and the potential for people to do unfortunate things around here seems to be fairly great. I mean, I get scared. Every time I hear a helicopter or a siren, I know, geez, something's going on.
We do have a lot of coastal hazards that people need to be aware of. Obviously, logs on the beach, you know, a log near the surf line, if it only takes about 3 inches of water to move a log, and they look, you know, large and stable, and kids want to go climb on them, or folks want to go climb on them, and then the water rolls in around the log, shifts it, and the person falls off and gets rolled over by the log. So that's always a serious concern. You want to stay away from logs near the surf line. Obviously, the water looks inviting, but our ocean water temperatures are very cool. And, you know, every year we deal with water rescues. We have rip currents along our beach line, all the beaches here in Oregon. And, you know, you can't ever be too careful because you can't fight Mother Nature when it comes to trying to, you can't swim against a rip current. If you do get caught in a rip current, don't fight it. You need to swim parallel to the beach until you're out of the rip current and then try to return to the beach.
You know, as you're saying these things, there are people who have lived here for many years that hopefully are aware of that, but you've got a constant population of people coming into the area who I assume you have to assume that your baseline knowledge is zero. I mean, you're saying this right now, but somebody who's visiting next week and isn't listening to this, right?
From the valley.
So, it's not that people are stupid, but they are ignorant. They're not aware of these things.
They're unaware of the hazards.
So, do you have any kind of ideas how would one get the word out? Do contact,
you know,
motels and campgrounds?
We do have, for example, in businesses downtown, we put out flyers about rip currents. The business downtown that rents out wetsuits and boogie boards and bicycles for the beach, they get the information. you know, we always try to keep the locals informed, so as they have visitors or the motels, they can answer questions and let people know of the hazards as well. But the fact remains that we have a transient population that comes and goes from all over the world virtually, and you know, you can't hit them all. You just try, but you know, unfortunately, every year people get in trouble.
We'll talk a little bit about just what motivates you and maybe your colleagues to do what you do. You've been involved in fire and rescue and personal safety, but early 90s here.
Well, actually the late 80s.
Late 80s.
Yeah, for about 23 years.
What motivated you to get into this?
You know, I think it's just the desire to help people. You know, as a young person, they're always excited about the adrenaline and the, you know, get to drive an emergency vehicle.
Have you gotten over that?
I'm so over that. The pager goes on. I'm like, oh, no, here we go. You know, and so it's just another call. But that was my biggest motivation. And, you know, and the desire to want to help the community. There's nothing more gratifying than a person who's in need that calls for help and you're there to solve their problem. You know, most of the time we're able to help them out and take care of the issues. And sometimes there's tragic events where, you know, it's too late by the time you're called or, you know, it's just a circumstance beyond your control. But, I think that's what motivates most of the folks that volunteer in the fire service that, you know, these are our friends, these are our neighbors, our family members, and who else is going to do it? You know, we don't have the resources down here to have paid folks. So, you know, it takes the volunteers to get the job done.
But then there's that something else, because as we are constantly and properly reminded, you know, when everyone else is running that way, you're running this way. That is abnormal behavior, let me say.
Well, I think, you know, in any situation, you know, that's where you resort back to your training. And it's actually the what you've trained for, and it's kind of like I don't want to say you lose that sense of fear, because you know you don't.
Fear is probably a good thing.
It is a good thing, but at the same time, you know, hopefully have trained and trained properly that you can assess the situation and know you can take care of that problem, and that's why you go take care of the problem.
What are some of the public safety issues around here that we should be aware of and are not? And I'm deliberately leaving out tsunami stuff for the end, but the less obvious things.
Well, you know, there's a lot of things that folks can do to mitigate situations. For example, again, we live in an area where, you know, we have people up and down the beach that love to have fires. People in their backyards have recreational fires. And I'll tell you, the vegetation here in the coastal community, you know, yeah, it's wet a lot of the times, but you get a fire going in the beech pines, and that's a hot fire that moves quickly because we usually have wind associated with it. So there are things, hazards, you know, people like their homes nestled right in the middle of all these trees and the vegetation around it. But, you know, cutting the vegetation back, having a clear path around your home. So one, if the fire department has to come, they can get around your home to do what they need to do. And two, you don't provide a fuel source right up to your home. You know, being, you know, people don't realize that they take their kids to the beach, and it's fun to let your kids wade in the water, keep them from the knee level down, realize that a sneaker wave could come in. They shouldn't be sneaker waves because, you know, they happen every so many sets, a larger wave comes in. Why we call them sneaker waves, I'm not sure, except people get caught off by surprise. And hold your child's hand. Don't leave them go, because if you're sitting 20 feet up the beach watching them and that wave knocks them down and it's dragging them back out, you're going to lose the race. So, you know, there are things that people should be aware of that we just don't take the time to think about. You know, having carbon monoxide monitors in your home. Quick story, 2007, during the multi-day power outage, out of all people, my family was home with the generator going. I'm here at the emergency operations center, and the sensors start going off in the house. And we have our generator outside. It's not in the garage. You know, people think, I'll put the generator outside where it's safe. Well, it was near a vent of the house, and the wind was pushing the fumes under the house, and I had to send somebody out to the house with a gas meter to check, and sure enough, high levels of CO in the house. So, you know, these are all things that can kill folks that we should be aware of, but you wouldn't think about those items normally. So Take the time to research. If you're going to use a generator or a gas appliance or anything like that, and you know carbon monoxide, take that seriously. Buy that monitor. It's a cheap device to save your life. Plugs into the wall and any hazard. My wife always says, "Oh, you're Mr. Safety. You know, you're paranoid," but you can't be too safe.
Well, it'd also be incredibly embarrassing for you.
Yeah, my family ends up croaking because of the CO poisoning.
Not a good advertisement for the whole operation. You mentioned the storm of a few years ago, which is another reminder how isolated we can become, and very, very easily. I mean, this area, the Nehalem Bay area, can get cut off pretty easily.
We 96 flood, the storm of 2007, flooding that occurred, the significant winds that we had, it took out power from Sunday to Thursday night. And there's a lot of little things that people didn't realize in that situation. People have refrigerated medications and different things like that, and here they're having an issue there. You have to be prepared. We have this North County Emergency Operations Center that'll be in a new station. And the reality was we became the North County 911. And when calls came in, they were routed to here because we had lost radio communications with Tillamook 911. So, that's one of the reasons why building this new station, we're trying to do things in there that benefit this community, and not just today, but in, significant incidents like that storm. Where we have to become a backup 911 and run operation center and not depend on other parts of the county.
So operationally, can the north part of Tillamook County be self-sustaining as far as from an emergency point of view? I mean, you can't prepare for every contingency, understand.
But. And realize that we can't take care of the entire community. 26 or 30 people, when everybody has a crisis, isn't going to be enough. And so, whether it's a wildfire, whether it's a... the big one, the earthquake, whatever, people have to prepare and take care of themselves. And that's what we've really been practicing since the early 90s.
And communicating their homes up, North Fork Road, isolated places.
And we have isolated pockets within our district.
Right. And how to get the word out to those people? That's the question without
exactly.
Maybe entirely
no,
an answer.
I hear you. And in fact, obviously we're building a substation on Highway 53, not because of just disasters, but because of the insurance service ratings that those folks receive out in that area to bring their insurance costs down to have a station within 5 miles of their home. But at the same time, because it's an isolated area during floods, which Tillamook County is prone to floods almost every year, every couple years, it will provide some response to those areas, although there are still areas that will still be isolated and people need to learn to take care of themselves.
It is interesting, though, that you mentioned with the internet, phone, satellites, everything else, you say we were north part of Tillamook County was actually cut off from 911?
We were cut off
from the central.
Our radio repeater sites were down. And so, yes, as far as our radio communications with 911, we still had radio communications. And fortunately, we still had phone service in our immediate area. We could not call long distance. So Rockaway is long distance from here. Cannon Beach is long distance from here. So Nehalem, Wheeler, and Manzanita and the outlying areas had phone service, but only for this area. So we were fortunate that way that we were able to take care of ourselves. And of course, we were able to contact dispatch through other means. Fortunately, our internet worked, but theirs didn't. So we had outside world communications. But there, I'm trying to remember. It seems to me we had some kind of phone contact with them at one point. But anyway, long story short, we had to take care of ourselves for the most part.
Our guest this morning is Perry Sherbaugh. He is the fire chief for the Nehalem Bay Fire Rescue District. And let's talk about the elephant in the room, because we always there are ice storms and flooding and the sad occasional fire, but everyone is always thinking about earthquake, tsunami. Are we prepared? I'm saying that even as I know that what happened in Japan, the most prepared country on earth, look what happened there. So what's it going to look like here?
Well, I think what first thing we need to ask ourselves is what is being prepared. If you're thinking that the fire department is going to come rescue you, and the fire department has taken certain measures, hopefully the building stands up, and we're not going to be there anytime soon, especially the volunteer department, because they're going to be taking care of their families before they even head to the station. So the first thing to realize is being prepared starts with the individual and their family. We need to make sure we train our volunteers to have your house in order, your family has a plan, so when it does happen, you're prepared, and then you can come help. If you're thinking you're going to run home because it just happened, you've waited too long, and you're not going to help your family at all because it's already occurred. So we have to prepare ahead of time. And what does that mean? For the citizens that live here, for the tourists that visit the area, they need to know where the hazard areas are. First, we have to survive the earthquake, and it's going to be a significant earthquake. We're talking 5 minutes of ground shaking that's going to knock you down. You need to get under a piece of furniture in your house, hold on to the furniture, just don't get under it, but hold on because it'll knock it over, and wait till the quake is over. If you live in an area where you're in the inundation zone, then you need to immediately evacuate to high ground, taking with you your emergency pack that should contain enough rations for you to survive for at least 3 days. The reality, probably longer. That's not just food, water, but if you depend on medications. Do you have a place that if your kids are at school, do they know where the inundation zone is in that area? Do you guys know how to contact each other if it happens? You should have a phone number out of state that you can call, and hopefully the phone service would be working. And I say out of state because a lot of times our local switchboards get overloaded and you have a better chance of reaching a relative out of state. So everybody calls that person and says, hey, I'm okay. Do you have a meeting spot to get to after the dust settles where you guys can get reunited? As a community being prepared, as each and every citizen being prepared. Here in the North County area, we have Map Your Neighborhood, where communities, blocks have gotten together. They have team captains, and they take care of so many homes within their area. And it's kind of becoming good neighbors again, if you will, knowing who your neighbors are, knowing who needs extra help. And we have a group called the Emergency Volunteer Corps, led by Linda Kozlowski. They are real active in this community I couldn't even tell you how many neighborhoods now they have with block captains and the CERT training, the community emergency response training that we have in this community. During the tsunami warning we had not too long ago, 4:30 in the morning, I called from the EOC, asked that CERT be notified or activated, and we had 33 CERT members at City Hall within a half hour at 4:30 in the morning. And they assisted with evacuation, going to the staging areas, giving people information. A lot of them have gotten trained as ham radio operators, so they had communications directly into the EOC, the Emergency Operations Center. And so, I would like to say that we probably have one of the most prepared communities along the coast for this. But are we ready? We're never ready. And there will be things that will happen that are beyond our control. The roads will be gone. They won't be drivable with that kind of an earthquake. So we just have to really do our best to be diligent, plan on foot transportation for a while, and having the supplies you need to get through it.
And fairly self-sufficient, because if it's happening here, there's going to be damage.
We're Portland, talking every, the entire every, coast.
So
they say
it could be days, weeks possibly.
Months. They say that everything west of the Cascades and basically the entire United States up through British Columbia, we're looking at mass catastrophe from the earthquake alone. Now you throw in the wave hitting the coast, and so we've got a compounded problem there. But it's going to be a while before things ever get back to the way we're used to them being.
So do you work and get together with your colleagues to the north and south? I won't say east, because there's not much east before it starts thinning out.
As far as, for fire, we have mutual aid agreements with all the other departments in the counties, Clatsop County, Cannon Beach, and we're working on two county mutual aid agreements. But when something like this happens, we're talking at definite isolation.
Yeah.
And, it'll probably be air and sea where we see help first coming into the area from, because it's going to be a while to get roads repaired. And so really, even though we talk with the folks and We try to come up with some plans. The reality is, you know, we mostly train to be self-sufficient.
What about communication to visitors in our area? We can't guarantee this isn't going to happen in the height of summer tourist season. There are all those folks out at the Halen Bay State Park staying in motels who probably are not as aware as they should be. How do we tell them the message that you just gave people who live here?
Well, you know, there's starting to be a more of a national campaign with information. Of course, the state's been doing a good job with doing communities up and down the coast and trying to get some of it televised. You know, I would think at some point, kind of like fire safety, I would hope that it would get taught in the schools and start. It's going to be a culture shift with the training that we start training our children to know what to do. And I don't just mean here along the Oregon coast, but it should be disaster preparedness should be taught throughout the country. One thing we do here locally is all of our motels have the flyers with the inundation map in the rooms, or they're supposed to have in the lobby area, and I believe a map on the back of the door, like a fire escape map. We also have they're supposed to have the tsunami. All of our short-term rentals, the city passed the ordinance that they have to provide information within the short-term rental, so when people are there, it has to be plain visible, so hopefully they'll pick it up and read it. So that's really what we're doing locally to try to get the word out, besides just word of mouth.
Well, back to the more mundane aspects of how we handle our summer. Any takeaway messages for the summer as we struggle to get ready for hopefully a busy tourist season?
Well, come to the beach and enjoy. Just be aware of the coastal hazards. You know, I mentioned the logs. I've mentioned the ocean being dangerous with rip currents. We have a lot of hiking trails that people end up twisting their legs, breaking their legs, sometimes falling off the cliff. You know, use common sense and realize that that's a significant hazard. I'll mention real quickly one as well. Just this last year, we had a 12-year-old boy get buried in the sand. They were digging a fort and dug down about 6 feet in the sand and had this big, nice wide hole. And while he was digging, it caved in on him. And he was in the sand for literally almost 10 minutes before we were able to get him out. Fortunately, he survived, but you know, that's a freak thing. But you know, the kids that dig in the dunes and try to create, you know, just for the fun of it, it can collapse on them. So that's something else for parents to be aware of.
Be aware of tides too.
Tides.
When not
going
to
out
go
on
out
the rocks when it's low tide and getting stuck and surrounded by water.
That should be an easy one, but it happens.
It does happen.
Well, thank you very much, Perry Sherbaugh, for taking the time. I'd like to wish you a busy summer, but I can hope you...
Wish me a slow summer.
A slow summer. I'll wish you a very slow summer with the Nehalem Bay Fire and Rescue District, the chief of the operation here. We thank you so much, and join us again next month for another edition of Neakani View. I'm Peter Newman. Thanks for joining us. Have a good day.